Yeah, hello again, and welcome to another episode of our podcast, Everyone Has a Story. This is the podcast that goes hand in hand with our quarterly lifestyle magazines. Hello, Sunshine Magazine and In Noosa Magazine, the autumn issues of both of those titles on the street right now. And if you'd like your business or your brand to be part of our next issues, our winter issues, reach out to our team. You can find us on Facebook and we're on Instagram as well. On with today's episode. Do you crave authentic Mexican flavors with a fresh local twist? In this episode, we journey from the Sapphire Coast to the Sunshine Coast with restaurateur Jason Jones. We'll explore his passion for Mexican cuisine, ignited by a childhood spent foraging and experimenting in the kitchen. Jason will share the story behind Mamacita, one of Melbourne's most beloved Mexican destinations. We'll also discover how his adventures abroad from Europe to Singapore influenced the creation of his current project, Bandita. Located riverside in Noosa, Bandita offers a unique take on Mexican food. Think fresh, local seafood cooked over fire alongside classic favorites like tacos and guacamole. But Bandita is more than just a restaurant, it's an experience. Jason believes in fostering a community around food and creating memorable moments for his guests. Join us as we delve into Jason's culinary philosophy, the inspiration behind Bandita, and the magic of dining riverside with a million-dollar sunset.
I grew up in Bamigui, Marimbula. Do you know that? South coast of New South Wales.
Yeah.
That little strip there is called the Sapphire Coast.
Yeah.
You know, it's very peaceful. It's very similar geographically, as in like, it's got a river and the headland and lots of national park and stuff. But I think it's 1,100 people around there as opposed to the 55,000 here.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, very small town, famous for fishing.
Yeah.
Fishing town. Yeah. Oysters, lots of oyster farms.
What's your relationship with the place where you grew up? I mean, I grew up in a very small place as well, Bundaberg, which is, you know, just up the road from here. Yeah. When you're young, your dreams and your aspirations are, I just got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny?
I think that's for everybody, isn't
it? But as when you get older, do you have, like, what are your memories? Do you have fond memories and some kind of entertained thoughts of returning?
I do.
Not really living there.
No, I do. I actually tried to convince my wife to. So there's two towns, Marimbula and Bamigui.
Yep.
They're not very far apart. I tried to convince my wife after, because we've just been living in Singapore before here.
Yeah.
So we had our kids there and we wanted to raise them somewhere nice. I tried to convince her, Marimbula, because I love it so much down there.
That would be like chalk and cheese, though, when you go from Singapore to...
Well, yeah, she's from Hobart. She's Tasmanian. And we met in Melbourne. So it's pretty close to Melbourne, it's a 7-hour drive.
Yeah.
It's kind of halfway between Sydney and Melbourne, but it's got an airport. It's got a beautiful forest. It's just like this. A bit colder.
Yeah.
So the winter time, the fire's going a bit longer. That's all. But it's very beautiful. But it's a bit sleepy in the winter. So my wife was like, I can't, it's too quiet.
Do you think that's from a nostalgic point of view? That's why we go, you know, retrospectively, when you think back on your childhood, you always go, gee, I had a great time. Gee, they were fun times. If I could go back there again, I could maybe relive that. But that's not really the case.
No, it's not. But because we had little kids and we were like, where are we going to raise them?
Yeah.
I have such an affinity with the place and I loved it so much that I was like, I want my kids to have what I had.
Yeah.
That nature and that, you know, just all of those beautiful things there.
Yeah.
So I think
you're right. Maybe that's when you're
happy there. But yeah, Amy wasn't so keen on Marimbula and Bamigui. I wouldn't live in Bamigui. It's very quiet. It's there's no opportunity for business or anything like that so much. So.
What do you, where did your passion for food come from? Was it something that came from your mum, your dad? What are your early memories of going, oh, gee, I'd like to expand and explore this a little bit more?
Well, we lived out of town. We had like 5 acres. We had a massive garden that I was taught, you know, gardening. There was an orchard. So after school, I would come home. I think a friend of mine that I was going to school with, his mother worked in a restaurant in town. And I thought that was really cool. So anyway, I think I was about 10 or 11. I started foraging out of our garden and the orchard and looking through recipe books like Woman's Weekly and, you know, watching Peter Russell Clark on the telly, and started creating little dishes probably from 11. I got a job in town on the weekends in a grocery store that did spit roast rotisserie chickens. So yeah, by the time I was 11, I was working, stuffing and trussing chickens for spit roast. I was cooking from our garden, our orchard. So I think the I don't know, that spark for the culinary side of life began around then, around 11 or 12. So yeah, I was cooking my own dinners by 12 or 13. I'd come home from school and make my own stuff.
What do you remember making?
Oh, just things like frittata.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. So eggs, you know, eggs from the chickens and veggies out of the garden and bake a frittata. I think Peter Russell Clark might have stemmed that one.
Is he still alive? I remember
he
him.
He is, yeah. He lives out
at... He had a potty mouth, didn't he? He
lives out at Ngambi because I did a skydiving. I did some, a jump in Ngambi. And the night before, I was in this tiny little town in a Thai restaurant. And Peter Russell Clark with his wife was sitting two tables away.
Yeah.
And I got to meet him and say, you are
an inspiration. Yeah, yeah.
I'm a chef now. I've traveled all around the world. Yeah. I've got a restaurant in... This is when Mama Cedar was open.
Yeah.
I was like, I've got a restaurant in Melbourne. And a lot of it was like, you inspired me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great that I got to actually...
I ask people this question and I guess I already know the answer for you. But are you doing now what you thought you'd be doing as a kid? Clearly at age 11 you're cooking your own and you're gardening, you're in the garden, you're in the kitchen. I guess you're living the life that you thought you'd always be living.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I never imagined that it would be as full on. You know, like there's a very romantic side to the idea of cooking and being a chef and having a restaurant. And, you know, there is a picture that probably a lot of people can see. But the reality is, like, it's hard work for sure, especially nowadays. Like to keep a small business afloat, it's tough times. So you got to be pretty clever about what you do.
Can you lift the veil on that a little bit? Because you are correct. We all, I mean, I've got no connection to hospitality whatsoever. But I've often entertained the thought of going, yeah, I'd love to run. But you're right. That's just the front.
The
romantic notion.
What's
the challenging part of running the business?
staff. Obviously everybody knows staff is a challenge. Finding good ones, keeping them, retention. It's very competitive, the market now. Like when I was an apprentice, I was applying for places with probably 20 or 30 other kids that wanted their apprenticeships. And back then, the employers got the choice to pick, you know, the best of the bunch. Now, there's 30 places looking for that one person. So it's totally flipped on its head. So finding staff's very tough. Retaining them's tough because there's so many competitors out there offering more and better hours and four-day weeks for more higher rate. So they get poached and they disappear. So that's pretty tough. The staff, obviously, I'm not quite sure how far I can go with it, but the Fair Work Ombudsman states we have to pay these penalty rates on these times. I think there's a little bit of room. It could be improved a little for the industry that you're in. So I understand it as a blanket rule. I think it's, if you work a 9-to-5 job, and you have to start at 7 in the morning and you're there till 9 o'clock at night, or you have to work on the weekend, 100% you should receive better remuneration. The penalty should be there for you because you've gone outside of those times. But this industry, our times of trade, are outside those times. You know, like we are open on the weekends. That's when people aren't working 9-to-5. That's when they come to our business. Yeah. So it's like, cool, come to our business. We will be open for you. But Fair Work says I've got to give my staff $50 an hour. So it's really, it just squeezes us.
Added pressure to the particular industry that you're in. Yeah, yeah.
The wage cost is very tough now. Like it used to be 20 years ago, no worries, 30%. You could hit a 30% wage cost of your turnover. Now it's, on average, it's between 45 and 50. So that bottom line is now smaller on your P&L. Yeah. So it, the wages and the staff, that's very tough. That's tough. Landlords increase rents according to the, you know, the CPI and all of that stuff. Yeah. It, not really regarding the fact that you might be having it tough. They're like, I'll just take more from you. So that makes it a bit harder.
Yeah. You're right, and these are all things that people don't the back end of the business.
I mean, we all know about iceberg lettuce was $10, right? We heard that one. So that just gives you an idea of the produce goes up in prices, right? So cucumbers, I'll get a bag of cucumbers, they're $50 or $60 for a bag of cucumbers. All of these increased prices to run a business, you can't pass it on to the guest. Because they won't come back again.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't sell a taco for $20.
No.
No, they'll just say you're a ripoff. Right?
And you're right, because your costings and price on the menu, I guess, at this end can't fluctuate as much as the produce that you're trying to purchase.
Yeah.
And that has massive fluctuations, doesn't it? Depending on season and weather events and all kinds of things. So you're right.
So I guess just that whole element of small business,
it's
tough. We've got restaurants in Singapore as well, because we were living there and we still have our restaurant. Yeah. I'm going there in a couple of weeks to change a menu. It's not too bad. I mean, each country's got their own pros and cons, right? Singapore is very supportive of small business. They don't hit you hard. They constantly are offering grants for whatever. You want to change some things in your venue, you want more technology, you want this, hit the government's like, here's a grant. We'll help you be better at your job. And they don't take very much off you in terms of taxes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they support their community so much that we don't have to give $20 or $30 an hour. You know, the average wage for a line staff is $10 to $15 an hour. Because that's enough for them, because they get a lot of support from the government.
Yeah. So, they're very progressive.
Yeah, very progressive.
I just remember watching on Netflix, there was that Secrets of the Blue Zone, Living to 100.
Right.
And they're trying to, the Republic of Singapore is trying to emulate a lot of those in terms of what do they have? An incentive if your parents live a certain distance from you.
Right.
It encourages that caring for your parents.
Yeah,
it encourages that walking. So
very
I under,
progressive.
But interesting hearing you talk, they're also...
For small business, they're very supportive.
Very, yeah.
So that's cool. That's why we've still got them over there.
Yeah.
But there's... You know what? The pros outweigh the cons. Like, it's very tough to do it.
Yeah.
But... in the essence of what we do, we can't stop doing it. I guess it's addictive, you know? You love to see people happy. You come in, and not just the guests, but the team as well. You know, you're providing a place where people come together, they create something, and then that goes on to the guests, and then the guests are happy. And then when you get good compliments from them, or, you know, the 5-star ratings, you feel good about it. So I guess it's this addictive nature of running the business, but it is quite full on, right? To keep it going and
all of that, the con part of the discussion, does that impinge on your creativity? Because being doing what you do, a large part of that is about the creativity.
So that's
apart from the feedback from your guests, you still get satisfaction from being creative in the kitchen, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess all it does is it gets in the way. The business management, operations and all that management stuff. Like today's Monday, I've got some bookkeeping to do. You know, I've got to do payroll. Yeah. I've got to work out the tips for the staff, make sure the food costs are right, catch up with the suppliers. There's operational management side of things, and I'm doing that. I'm not being creative, you know. I'm not thinking about what is a marinade that I could, you know, do with a lamb rump right now, you know. So I guess it just gets in the way. But it's all about time management. So you put these where they need to be in the calendar. Here's my hours for that. And then you get snippets of time where I can be like, you know, usually it's probably 9 or 10 o'clock at night, where I get to sit back and go, cool, let's have a flick through some of my books, look through some of my old recipes. Let's pull Frankenstein together, and it's a delicious idea. I'm going to order some stuff in next week, and I'm going to have a little bit of time to play in the kitchen. And so creative just has to be time management. It has to be put in at the right time.
There's so much to cover, Jason. I'm not sure where to... You mentioned Singapore. I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But also Mamacita. I mean, if you Google that name or that brand,
right.
The reviews, the love online for that, incredible. So do you want to talk about starting that, being part of that brand?
And sure,
you mentioned
sure.
just before, was it, when was it, 2004?
2010.
2010.
Yeah, February 10.
And what part of Melbourne was it in?
CBD on Collins Street.
Yeah, right.
Yep. It was upstairs. So usually doing a restaurant upstairs in the city can be a tough
tricky
call. Yep, yep. People don't like to have to go up the stairs. It was a restaurant bar called Recorded Music Salon, and they're really lovely guys who had it, but it just wasn't kicking the goals. I think they were considering closing it down. But a friend of mine, Matt Lane, he had just come back from New York. He'd been working in a Mexican restaurant over there. And he met them and, like, you know, they said, we need something to happen to this space. At the same time, he came and saw me. Because we met, I was in Byron Bay working there when he had a cafe in Mullumbimby. This is years ago. And we hooked up again in Melbourne. I'd just moved back from Europe and was going to open a high-end Spanish tapas restaurant in Melbourne. But it didn't work out. With the partner I had, it didn't eventuate. And so at that very moment, when my friend Matt Coop came back from New York, I was at a loose end and this venue was up for grabs, basically. So Matt's like, let's do a Mexican restaurant. So I was like, yep, cool, let's do it. So trip to Mexico, then opened up the doors, and then it went gangbusters. Like, it just went gangbusters.
I want to understand, and from other business and entrepreneurs that might be listening, what do you put that down to? What's the secret of this? What were all the ingredients, the elements that came together that made that brand such a that restaurant such a success?
Yeah.
Was it timing as well?
I think the timing was good in the sense that, because Mexico, Mexico's, would it be third world or second world?
That's a good question. I went there a long time ago.
Third or second world. It's kind of poor.
Yeah.
And the community of Mexico, like the population, weren't really able to travel internationally so much, whether that's got to do with passports or money as such. So the world wasn't really open to Mexico a lot. I guess that's why the world got exposed to Tex-Mex so much, because America could travel. And America traveled, or people traveled to America, and Tex-Mex was very embedded in a lot of countries. And people thought that's what Mexican food is, I guess, Tex-Mex. So up until we opened Mamacita, there was only two real offerings, which was Tex-Mex or really authentic Mar and Pa style Mexican. You know, like proper traditional.
Was
there? Yeah,
it
yeah.
existed?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. Right. There was probably two or three in Melbourne that were Ma and Pa, very small little, you know, and you'd get things like mole or, you know, they made handmade stuff and it was like delicious but rich and full on. But a lot of the community were like, this is not Mexican, because they want Tex-Mex, you know, we want nachos, we want
an understanding
big enchiladas and burritos and fajitas and all that stuff, right?
That's what they've been trained.
They've been trained to eat. This is Mexican and it's cheap and it's massive and it's right.
Yeah.
So I think when we opened Mamacita, Mexico had started to get out there a bit more. So, and people maybe started to travel to Mexico a bit more. So I think there was a beginning of exposure to actual awesome Mexican food. And when we opened in Melbourne, there wasn't we're kind of like a new thing. We weren't traditional or Tex-Mex. We were a bit more modern, but we're a bit more, I don't know, there was the big girl on the wall and there was the music and it was fun. And there wasn't any, you know, non-reservations, buzzy place to go to. There's lots of amazing restaurants in Melbourne, as there is. But not that casual dining that had something really different about it.
Yeah.
So I guess we opened it and we nailed the food and drinks. We made sure it was delicious and tasty. We made sure the price point, we wanted to get $45, $50 a head. We didn't want $100. We just wanted a small amount. We were hoping that we'd do at least 100 people a night after a couple of months. And I think it was like within 3 nights, we were doing 300 or 400 people a night. So it's a pretty fast learning curve. Yeah. And I guess that buzz, that waiting on the stairs and that buzz and the hubbub of people saying, you've got to get to check this place out. It just grew and grew and grew. And then there was a queue at the door for like over a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was insane. That was great. Off the back of that, we got lots of we got reached out to for lots of opportunities, and I guess after a couple of years, I was pretty tired of you know, hundreds of people every night. So I was like, we need to get another head chef, and I need to take a back step from this. And Singapore was one of the opportunities that they reached out to me and said, we want to open a restaurant in Singapore. I'd been in Melbourne 9 years by that stage. And I was ready for something new. And so was my wife. We just got married. She was keen to live in another country.
Yeah.
So we moved over there. Yeah.
What year was that?
15.
Uh-huh.
15. And then we had grand plans. The partners there, they wanted to open in Tokyo and Kuala Lumpur, Bangkok, all these places.
What did you think of that?
Oh, that was, we wanted to get to Japan. That was our, like, well, yeah, we want to live in Japan.
Mexican,
so
in Japan.
Singapore's the steppy. Yeah. Because I love Japan. Have you been?
No,
you
but been? I love the culture. And
it's
and
excellent. They don't know how to do shit. You know, they don't do bad quality at anything, right? It's not part of their DNA.
Precision.
Oh,
they're very precise.
Oh, they spend their life making sure something is perfect, right? So there is no bad quality over there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love the place. The nature of the people is beautiful. But I was like, if I can have a restaurant in Japan that goes well, that people love, for me, that's I've hit my pinnacle.
Yeah.
I've got a business.
That was your benchmark.
That's my benchmark.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got people that, in as far as the planet's concerned, are very good at quality. And if I can be in there and holding my own there, I'm content. And we never got to Tokyo because we opened one in Jakarta.
Okay.
And we had it for a couple of years. It didn't work. We tanked.
Well, why? Explain that. I want to understand why.
Well,
culturally?
It was a joint venture. And with the crew that were there, they were very successful with lots of other restaurants. They've got about 12 brands. They put it down to bad timing. The Jakarta wasn't ready for my style of Mexican food. I put it down to the location.
Oh, yeah.
We opened up in a very well-to-do mall. Now, have you been to Jakarta?
No.
Okay. There's a very big, there's no middle class. There's a very, very, very wealthy and very, very poor.
Yeah.
You know, you've got 95% of the population that are super poor and you've got 5% that are super rich. And so we opened in this mall that's like for the super rich. Basically, our restaurant was between Prada and Gucci or Rolex. It was Rolex and Prada were our neighbors. And we were in this shopping mall and it was like, you know, dripping wealth, you know, bling everywhere. And we, you know, like we're asking people to drink mezcal and eat tacos with your hands. And the businesses that do really well over there are shaving white truffles and serving burgundy. And, you know, like in that area. So they want to be European. And when you try and sell an exotic flavored food to a country that's already got really exotic flavored food, it doesn't, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not a slam dunk. Mexican food is excellent for the Western palate because we grew up with different style of food. And when you eat Mexican, it's exotic flavors.
It's
like really interesting. It's fun and delicious and all that. You know, it's like trying in selling Mexican food to Indonesian people. It's like selling ice to Eskimos, right? They've already got this really amazing cuisine.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, you know what? Ours is kind of pretty good too.
Yeah.
So it doesn't blow them away.
Yeah.
Not like Mama Sita did in Melbourne, you know? It's like, here's some really interesting flavors you probably never had before, eaten in a way that you don't eat at home.
Yeah.
And for you, that's like, that's new and fun and exciting and exotic.
Great insight. I really appreciate what you're saying and understand what you're saying. But is that not the case for Singapore as well?
Singapore's got a huge expat community.
Huge. That's the market that you were tapping into.
And
whose palate still needed to be tempted or trained.
And even the Singaporeans, right? Unlike, you know, we talked about Mexicans a long time ago couldn't really travel, couldn't afford to travel.
Yeah.
Indonesians, the majority of the population, don't travel too much, visa purposes and money. Singapore, different story. It's the traveling hubbub, right? Singaporeans, they've for a long time have had access to travel and the income to do it. So they're already enlightened on cuisines of the world. And so when you bring that to them, that's cool. Like, they already know all these different cultures and different cuisines.
Educated.
Right. They've been exposed to it. So they are fine. They accept it. But this huge expat community, and you know, in a way, Singapore, even though it's in Asia, the community is very kind of westernized, I guess. Yeah. You know what I mean? Rather than being sheltered in a eastern bloc only. Yeah.
From there, how did you end up here on Gympie Terrace?
Oh, so whilst we were in Singapore, we were blessed with two children that were born there. Two little boys, and they need to go to school, right? They're going to grow, and as much as Singapore is a great place to dine, to go out, the dining scene is probably one of the world's best. For traveling, it's excellent. Like, to get to Europe or to the rest of Asia or even Australia, it's in a great location, and running business is awesome. So it ticks a lot of boxes for us, for those things. But the kids, we want them to grow up where our roots are. You know, like this air, this culture, our families, you know, like our Australian way of life, we enjoyed it. And that's who we are. It's the essence of us. So we want them to have that and not be, you know, not miss out on it. So Singapore doesn't provide a lot of those things. It's also very expensive school fees, international school fees. If we're involved in a big global banking corporate place, they'd pay the fees for us. But we're small business, so coughing up, you know, they're like $15,000 to $20,000 a semester per child.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So we're talking, you know, $150,000 a year for two kids to go to school.
All right.
So it's really expensive.
I get it. So Bandita became the vehicle or the idea or the impetus or the catalyst for bringing the boys back, bringing you guys back and going, look at the views, great. And so it was like, what, can I do this here?
No, actually Noosa was, where are we going to live? Like, what are we going to do? We have to move back to Australia financially and for their benefit, the kids' benefit. So we did a process of elimination. You know, there was Margaret River on there, Adelaide Hills. Yeah. Like, we did a list of some really cool places in Australia, and this one, Noosa won. Yeah, because it is excellent. It is such a cool place. So we chose here to raise our family.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, we've got to find a home, you know, we've got to buy a home. We did that like COVID sight unseen, buy a house from Singapore. We did a recce first. We came and did a bit of a, you know, stayed in an Airbnb in Doonan and then did a whole check out of town. But I guess Bandita was born out of the want to do another business. What doesn't Noosa have, you know, like in terms of our style of, you know, like it's probably wise to do another Mexican because we've been doing it for so long now and we love this style. Like, to turn around and throw a Thai restaurant in would be great, fun, but probably not quite the smartest thing to do.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're like, let's do a Mexican, but what is there already? So we checked out all the Mexican places.
Many, is it?
Well, there's not that many, but they, you know, they have their style about them. And we're like, okay, we won't do the same as them. We'll make it our style, but, you know, we do want a location that has indoor and outdoor. We would love to have a view of the water.
Yeah.
it's going to be a restaurant, you know, table service, not counter service. It's, you know, we want to cook with fire and smoke and, you know, use the lots of seafood like Kusnoosa, Maroochydore, Mooloolabah, Harvey Bay. Like there's the seafood's pretty good along here. So I was like, okay, it's going to be a menu that has like seafood barbecue style thing. That's what the other places aren't really doing. So we kind of narrowed it down. I mean, you can't not do pulled pork taco or, you know, chips and guacamole and all the classic, the corn on the cob, you know. Yep. So
they're yeah. kind of your staples, but you examined and wanted to explore and exploit, you know, the of what other people weren't doing in terms of...
Yeah, not to be too much of a competitor yeah. to them, to be more of a companion in
point
that.
Point of difference.
Yeah, point of difference. And try and... You know, I guess I've always had that mentality that all the other Mexican places create a community. We're all trying to give people flavors, you know, of Mexico. So I find that they're companions, not competitors.
Yeah.
But so I wouldn't want to do a mirror image of them. I wouldn't want to try and do the same business model that they do. It has to be a little bit different. So
when yeah. someone comes to Bandita and they have some cocktails and they enjoy the food here, what when they leave, what's the kind of thing that you would love them to say to their friends, to talk to their friends about this, about Bandita? What kind of experience do you want to leave them with?
I guess a unique one, unique and memorable. So I guess the memorable part is having it, like, you know, ticks all the boxes in terms of comfort, environment, service, the product, the price point. So they're all like, yeah, everything was good. The boxes were ticked. Having something different that they haven't had before, that's always good. You know, an appreciation that we are just trying to use a lot of local stuff and keep it fresh and light and easy, not overcomplicated. And just that special, I don't know, it's a special occasion. Not that I want it to be you only come for a special occasion, you know, but each occasion should be special. It should be treated warm, friendly. You have a nice time. But then when you go away, because it was so good, you remember it and you say to your friends that you got to go and try it. Yeah.
You're talking about the seafood. Yes, we have great seafood suppliers, but talk a little bit more about some of the other products that you have on the menu and where they come from and the people that supply Bandita.
Oh, okay, yeah. Produce Wholesalers, our fruit and veggie guy, they're a family, they're local. We get mushrooms from Kin that, you know, they've got a lion's mane one on at the moment, which is all the rage, especially in Singapore. Everyone's loving lion's mane. We get the, you know, pineapples and ginger and things that are like, they're kind of from this area.
Unique to this area,
you know?
Yeah.
So we've got a salsa, you know, there's a spicy salsa with corn chips that's barbecue pineapple and ginger. And it's because the big pineapple's down the road and the ginger factory's out there, obviously.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I don't know. We try to utilize what's from here as much as possible. You can't, being Mexican, you can't just be local produce only. No one's really producing chipotle or dried guajillo chilies or, you know, we still have to get, I get a weekly shipment from Fireworks Foods in Sydney. They do a lot of Mexican import. Yeah. They import Mexican stuff.
Well, it's a balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's in terms of getting those really traditional Mexican ingredients and then also...
And then just combining it with as much as local as we can,
guess. Yeah, well, that's great.
Yeah, so...
Is that challenging, coming up with stuff like that in the kitchen? Or that just would be quite
fun,
enjoyable, wouldn't
fun,
it?
Yeah, more fun than challenging. Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, I love it. Like, I just said the lion's mane mushroom. That's... You know, we marinate it and grill it and serve it. It's got a cashew sauce. But I put like a cooked pureed huitlacoche, which is a Mexican ingredient. And it's got a real earthy mushroom flavor to it. They call it the Mexican truffle. But if you Google imaged huitlacoche, you probably wouldn't want to eat it.
If I write this in the story, just, I'm going to have to Google the spelling.
The spelling,
so I can get it right.
It starts with a H. It's H-U-I-T. L-A-C-O-C-H-E.
Thank you for
Huitlacoche.
That. Makes it easier.
Yeah. So, Yeah, it's like a fungus that grows on the corn cob.
Yeah, right.
And they harvest it, and they, yeah, Mexican truffle they call it. But it's like, yeah, it's like a mushroom from corn.
Wow.
And it's a really interesting flavour. But yeah, so there's Mexico mixed with local ingredients.
Great.
For a dish, yeah.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think would be really important to this conversation and the story that I'm going to write about Bandita? There's something that you want, maybe someone that hasn't visited this place yet, to know.
I think sunset, this venue that we picked, the sunset on the river is amazing.
Yeah.
That's around 5:30, 6 o'clock.
All seasons or any particular season?
Winter's best. Winter yeah. is best.
Because
you
sure. see it right through there. Because it's a bit lower, right? The sun.
The sky is just amazing. And sitting out here with, you know, a cocktail or a glass of wine and some Mexican snacks and the sunset, it's pretty good. Like, you know, I must say.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not the kind of person that sort of, I don't big up too much, you know. I'm like, hey, we're trying to do something nice.
Yeah.
We think it's good. We're doing the best we can.
Yeah.
If you like it, great. You know, we're not for everybody as well. You know, you can't please everybody. You just can't.
That's true, I think.
You really can't. Some people come and it's not what they expected.
I find that hard to... find that hard to believe sometimes when someone is passionate and they put their heart and soul into a business or a brand? You know, I can see how passionate you are about what you create, and people would still whinge about something.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like you are correct. That you can't.
I guess there's the stigma of the Tex-Mex floating in their head. You know, like where's
they
the
need
big
to be
stuff?
Re-educated. I suppose.
Where's the big massive cheap stuff?
You point them to the other franchise. Yeah.
Well, you know, like no, I don't disrespect Tex-Mex at all. I think it's actually good at a certain time and place. You know, like if you've had a big night out and you just need some. You know, some heavy, rich, tasty stuff. Go for it. Go hit it. Like, it's delicious. But for me, it's not a diet. Like, if I want a delicious dinner that I feel nice afterwards, you know, because we're quite clean with our flavours. Not too much
cheese.
You don't
feel guilty afterwards.
Yeah, you don't want to feel guilty. You want to go away going, that I feel great. Like, I'm coming back. I could eat that tomorrow, you know. I think that's what we try to achieve, but... I think if anyone's going to come here, take a bit of time, don't be in a rush, and try a few things, you know, or let us feed you. Just say, you just tell us what you think we should eat.
Restaurateur Jason Jones was my guest on today's episode of our podcast, Everyone Has a Story. If you enjoyed the episode, please feel free to share it about on your social media platforms. Until next time, take care.